many times a controversial passage, but I think it's pretty straightforward. It's hard to imagine for us how important place was and place is to the Jewish people. We flew from New York City to Tel Aviv and were surrounded by people of Jewish roots, traveling back to the Holy Land. Yarmulkes were everywhere in the plain. Today in ancient times, the Jewish people traveled to the ancient city of Jerusalem singing the Psalms of Ascent, Psalm 120 through 134. One of the best books on that is by Eugene Peterson. It's called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. They were long obedience of walking to Jerusalem. Carrie and I were talking this week, and I was listening to a podcast, and it was on that idea, but I didn't know this. 17 times that book was rejected by publishers. 17 times. And it's a classic. People read it and talk about it still, years and years later. The Psalms of Ascent, unless the Lord builds the house, its builders labor in vain. When the Lord brought back the captives to Zion, we were like men who dreamed. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Those who trust in the Lord are like Mount Zion, which cannot be shaken but endures forever. I will lift up my eyes to the hills. And every time I think of that psalm, I lift up my eyes to the hills, I think of Beasley Hill. Where does my help come from? They're walking to Jerusalem and they looked up to the hills and there were shrines on the hills to foreign gods. It didn't come from them. Where does my help come from? From the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. When we look up to Beasley Hill right now, we see an American flag. It's not where our help comes from. Have you ever sung over a city in great joy because you have been away but returned with great deep spiritual longing to connect with God that you've experienced in that place before? Monday of Holy Week, 2019, flames captured the imagination of the world. Beauty was reduced to ashes. Architectural brilliance crumbled. Vigils were kept at Our Lady Notre Dame that filled the air, that cathedral filled the air with flame and danger and smoke, and people wept. The French magazine Paris Match cried, "Today they weep for her, Notre Dame, in every language," they wrote. The church's 750-ton spiral crashed to the ground. Now, Paris is the epicenter of secularism, of atheism, of enlightenment, just thinking of Sartre. And yet, when the fire threatened to destroy the whole cathedral, people gathered, they sang hymns, they prayed, emotions wet their cheeks. It is impossible to step into a Notre Dame Cathedral or one of Carrie's and my favorite, the Münsterkirche in Basel, Switzerland, or the Sistine Chapel, or the Princeton Chapel on the screen, and not be impressed. If there ever was a place to connect with God, one of these would seem to be it. The beauty is breathless. Their transcendence is silencing. The colors are haunting in those places. Everything about them shouts that there is more reality than what you can see. The voices of such places of beauty and grandeur, they silence us. You walk in and all of a sudden you realize you better be quiet in these places. Well, when it comes to Luke 21, we find ourselves entering the Olivet Discourse. The synoptic gospels, now the word synoptic just means similar. Mark, Matthew, Luke. And I said it in that way because Mark was written first, Matthew second, and Luke third. And Matthew and Luke had Mark in front of them, we think, because they pull on that. He pulls on that. In Luke 13, we've been going through Luke, Jesus cries out, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem." There's a sense of doom when he says that. Jerusalem's coming to an end. "You killed prophets, stone messengers. I have longed to gather your children like a hen gathers her chicks, but you've resisted. You won't see me again," he says, "until the branches are laid on the ground while you sing, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" But then he says this, "But no, no, your house will be left desolate." Desolate. This is Jesus speaking. The house of worship, the temple, is going to be destroyed. In Luke 19, Jesus is riding into Jerusalem. People are chanting, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." He is on the road that goes from down from the Mount of Olives. As you travel this path, as Carrie and I have walked it, you come to a spot where the ancient city is like in your face. And if you've ever been backpacking or on the mountains and you come to an opening and all of a sudden there's these glaciers right there and it's like you can reach out and touch them. It's like that when you're walking down the Mount of Olives and you see the holy city. We are told that when Jesus saw the city, he wept over it. People, even the disciples, don't understand. Because he's not going to start a revolution in Jerusalem. He won't take power. He won't take position by the sword. He will be crowned with thorns as king, as he's enthroned on the cross. That's who Jesus is. "Behold your God." At this weeping spot on the Mount of Olives, there's a Franciscan structure, Dominus Flevit Church. It's called the Teardrop Chapel. Jesus knows what is coming. The picture on the front of your bulletin is looking from inside that chapel out at Jerusalem. He is stepping into the human delusion. Jesus is the human delusion, our delusion of who we think God is. He's changing the way we perceive God. We've got it all wrong. He reveals God in his death. Our story in Luke 21 starts with Jesus, and I'm going back four verses. He's watching people give money at the temple, because we're talking about the temple. The rich stood at the box and dramatically pulled out their checkbooks with a solid gold pen in their hand. They made sure the eyes watched as they filled out the amount and they ripped off the check from the book and then they dropped it into the coffer. Behind them waited a woman. Her feet were blistered and bloody. Her skin spotted with dirt. Her clothes tattered. She quietly dropped a couple of pennies into the offering box. She, not the wealthy, she caught the eye of Jesus. She's the one he noticed. And he praised her generosity to the disciples. Now, just fill in the gap here for a minute between here and verse 5 that was read by Anita. What do you think the disciples were saying to each other at this point? They are standing in the temple with Jesus. Maybe they had exited and had a full view in verse 5. There's not a greater structure than the temple in the city. Not a greater structure. King Herod built the temple. If there's anything Herod knew how to do, the dude could build. The biggest mountain in the area was Herod's tomb mountain, and he built the mountain bigger than any other mountain in the area to house his body when he died. The temple makes our cathedrals look like chapels. The temple was 400 yards by 500 yards. 400 yards by 500 yards. 4 football fields by 5 football fields. Foundation stones, when you go down, are 50 feet long 7 feet wide and 9 feet deep, one stone. Herod knew how to build. Can you imagine how much it costs to maintain that temple? Think of that. How much did it cost to maintain it? A couple pennies won't pay the light bill or the cleaning bill. It won't even pay for cough drops. I wonder if Peter, who knows to speak first and think later, asked, you know, guys, do you think Jesus has lost his mind? Do you think Jesus has lost his mind? 2 cents is not worth the treasurer. It's not worth Mary taking the time to count it. 2 pennies? Look at this place. Have you ever seen the likes of this kind of place? It makes me feel so small and so insignificant. How can Jesus not be impressed with this place? How can he not see the need for big checks written with a golden pen? Judas, at this point, probably pulled Peter aside close up to his ear and said, hey, Pete, I'm with you. I'm with you. I see the need for money. We find the disciples in verse 5 impressed with the beautiful temple stones and with the gifts dedicated to God, it says. That's what they were impressed with. The gifts dedicated to God and the beauty of this place, the stones. Their perspective was tainted by the power of money, the prestige of their culture that set them apart from other people, and their tradition that saturated the temple. Their chests were puffed out. The ancient Jewish historian Josephus, this is how he describes the temple, so you get an idea. The exterior of the building lacked nothing that could astonish the soul or the eyes, for being covered on every side with massive plates of gold. I just need to say here, I could care less about a White House filled with gold. It's repulsive. The sun had no sooner risen than it radiated to a fiery flash that those straining to look at it were forced to avert their eyes from the solar rays. To approaching strangers, it appeared from a distance like a snow-clad mountain. The reason being that what was not overladen with gold was purest white. That's the temple. But Jesus' perspective is different. Jesus applauded 2 pennies over a $100,000 check. Do you remember the conversation with the woman at the well that Jesus had? The woman said that the Samaritans worship on their mountain, their place, but you Jews, she said, you Jews claim that the place of worship is Jerusalem. And how does Jesus respond? He says, a time is coming. And now has come when you will not worship the Father on this Samaritan mountain, nor in Jerusalem. That's all going away. Because true worshipers will worship in spirit and truth. Peter said there's a living stone and it's Jesus. And that we're all living stones because we're the temple. So when we gather in together, the Jesus is here, the living stone, and he's in us who is the temple. You're the temple of the Holy Spirit. Place, you see, will be replaced. That's what Jesus is saying. Jesus looked at the center. He looked at the place of Jewish life where God and the people met in worship and sacrifice, the temple. And he says to his awed disciples, as for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down. So what is Jesus doing here? He's the doctor. And he pulls out his prescription pad. And he writes a diagnosis for hospice and says Jerusalem temple on it. It's a great picture. That's what he's doing. This huge, ginormous temple is on hospice. The temple age is coming to an end. The new living temple is present. It's Jesus Christ. I mean, the Synoptic Gospels take different angles on Jesus' life, emphasizing different things while downplaying others. They have their own theological agenda in writing biographies of Jesus. John, specifically, he's very unique. And he gives the material of our passage, but he gives it at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry and not at the end. Jesus enters the temple, he makes a whip, and he boots out those mocking the temple's purpose. And then he says, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." And Jesus is going to reconstruct the entire system of worship in 3 days that took 46 years to build. It took 46 years to build the temple. The massive stones that enticed the disciples will be rubble, but Jesus was talking, John tells us, about his body. The temple age is ending. That's what this passage is about. Jesus is clear in Luke 19, not one stone will be left upon another. The temple age is ending. There is no need for Jewish people to build a temple today for end times to fall into place. Returning to any kind of sacrificial system is an anathema. It's a sacrilege to Jesus' sacrifice, the once-for-all sacrifice of God. This place, the temple, as the point of meeting between God and his people is dissolving, Jesus says. What happened when Jesus was enthroned as king and died screaming, "It is finished"? The temple curtain separating the people from the Holy of Holies was torn from top to bottom. Place, the temple, is replaced by the person, Jesus Christ. So this morning, you and I need to ask, how central is Jesus Christ in our thinking, in our living, in our being? The disciples want to know when this is all going to take place. When will the temple be destroyed? And Jesus speaks directly to these disciples. He isn't predicting the end of the world. He's prophesying the end of the temple age. In verse 32, this generation will not pass away until these things have happened. Majority of scholars think Jesus died in 30 AD. Some will say 33. It tilts towards 30. The temple was leveled in 70 AD. A generation after Jesus gave these words. Generation is 40 years. 30 plus 40 is 70. 70 AD is when the temple was destroyed. When the disciples ask their question about when the temple will crumble, they're not thinking about the end of the world, the end time. They're enamored with the temple grandeur and are trying to get their heads around the idea of this structure crumbling. I want you to know, I grew up with the hype of Jesus returning. After my dad died in 1970, I remember standing at the upstairs window just outside of Detroit, wondering if Mom would return or if I'd been left behind. Not making that up. Russia was written into the book of Revelation. World events were culminating in a good and evil conflict. The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey captivated the imagination of many. Left Behind books and movies have carried on that hype and also that bent thinking. But that is not what Jesus is talking about here. He's talking about the destruction of the temple. History's not ending, but the temple age is. It's done. From 20 BC to 120 AD, wave after wave, there were claims of people to be the Jewish Messiah. The first Jewish war was in 66 AD, and it lasted until 73 AD, and it's a revolt against Rome. In the middle of that, the temple is destroyed. In the 60s, there was a famine, plagues in the city. The 10th Roman Legion, led by Titus, surrounded Jerusalem in 70 AD. People tried to get out. They ate their money. That's how they hid it. And as they were leaving, and they're trying to sneak out, not one of them survived. The Romans grabbed them. They disemboweled them alive to get the money. They cut off food supplies to the city. They had surrounded the city. Those that tried to escape, they were crucified. Until the Romans ran out of trees. Jerusalem became hell. But before all of this, Jesus tells his followers what to expect. Persecution, prison, interrogation before officials. Some, and maybe most of you, he said, will die. Authorities will kill you. Even friends and family will be so disturbed by your witness of me, Jesus says, that death will result. And this is what we find. Peter and John are handcuffed and jailed in Acts 4. Stephen is stoned in Acts 7. James is killed in Acts 12. Peter is jailed again in chapter 12. Paul and Silas are imprisoned in Acts 16. Paul gets arrested in Acts 21. We know that Paul and Peter are martyred under Nero. All but John the Beloved are eventually killed. And yet, this is what Jesus says at the end of this. Not a hair of your head. Not a hair of your head will perish. You're going to get killed, but not a hair on your head will perish. You're going to get killed, but not a hair on your head will perish. You're going to die with a full head of hair, even you bald people. He says this to his disciples. He's talking to his disciples. He tells us in Luke 12 that five sparrows are sold for 2 pennies. 2 pennies dropped by the poor woman in the offering box. Not one sparrow, he says, is forgotten by the Father. Know that all the hairs on your head are numbered. If you are truly completely bald, by genetics or chemotherapy, Jesus says that all the hairs on your head when you were 5 years old are known to God. And then in Luke 12, we hear the words, so don't be afraid. In Luke 21, we hear, stand firm, and you will live. Stand firm in the person of Jesus Christ, and you will live. Because Jesus says, I am the resurrection, and I am the life, he said. He is life. How do we win life? It's not about the temple. It's not about a place. It's about a person, Jesus. It's not about a place, but about a person named Jesus. It's not location, but it's Jesus. So ask yourself, as we come to the table this morning, how enthralled are you with Jesus? His words. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the hungry. Blessed are the persecuted. Blessed are those who forgive their enemies. Not how enthralled are you with ideas of Jesus, theology of Jesus, denomination, group identity, politics, or answers to questions that haunt you. Or speculation about this world and how it will end. How passionate are you and I just about knowing the Jesus of this meal? The temple age is finished. The living temple has come. He has a name. It's Jesus Christ. Where are you at with him this morning? Where am I at? In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, let's pray.